Hello and welcome back to the How To Fitness podcast with me, Michael Ujoa.
And me, Kate Lyman.
And today we're coming at you with another deep dive. Kate, what are we chatting about today?
Okay, well, first thing I want to say is I've got a new mic going on. I've got a new mic set up and I'm nervous about it. And I have my fingers crossed that it works. We're constantly battling Mexico. It's How To Fitness against Mexico.
I like to think that we're maybe just winning, only just. But
barely.
What could go wrong? New tech, recording a kind of in-depth episode. We really don't want to mess up. It'll be fine.
Right. So please wish us luck. But today we're going to talk about alcohol. And like, deep breath, because this is a really loaded topic. We've talked about diving into this topic of alcohol and drinking culture and the impact on our health and wellness and nutrition. And there's a lot, there's so much to talk about. There is, you know, these risks and benefits and how we can weigh the two. And there's how alcohol impacts us and how we feel and how we perform and the way it's classified. And it's just really loaded. And our goal is always to help the listeners, and I think ourselves as well, be more educated consumers. I feel like I say this every single episode. And I really want to go into this topic today, taking the morality out of it, because I think this topic is loaded with a lot of like attacking of character. And like, we don't need to do that today. It's really touchy. There's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of ways to direct this conversation. So I hope I have done it in a good way. I don't know. We're going to see.
I'm sure you will. I have no doubt about that, Kate. It's a funny topic, isn't it? Because I feel like, especially within the fitness scene, people can be really judgy of alcohol, but also people can be quite defensive when we start talking about alcohol too. So I think trying to find a nice balance between the two is probably going to be a challenge. I'm sure some people may listen to this and think you've not done that very well, or you've maybe not done that justice, because I think the way that our relationship with alcohol is very unique and personal, depending on previous experiences and how it impacts you as a person. So I hope that people kind of go into this episode with an open mind, with some healthy discussion about to come their way, but we will see. Please give us feedback. We always welcome it, but I'm sure you'll do it justice, Kate. I'm certain.
Thanks. We're going to see. And I love any time that episodes can generate some discussion. So super open to that. I'd love to hear some back and forth, because as hard as I've tried to touch on a lot of different things, I know that so much is missing from this conversation. And I want to start first to talk about these two terms that I think are really incorrectly used often, and that's objective and subjective. You hear people mess them up all the time. Objective information, it's fact-based, it's measurable, it's observable, it's unbiased, and it's verifiable, right? And today, a majority of what we're going to talk about is objective information, because I want us to talk about facts. I have opinions. I have opinions. You have opinions on alcohol and different experiences consuming alcohol, and I want us to get to those at the end, because I think those are important as well. But that's subjective information, which is more personal opinion and kind of colored by our individual bias. And I want to start talking about facts. And if we what we know about objective information is that it aims to communicate the truth without distortion of personal feeling or opinion. And that's how I want to approach this today, because there's a lot to talk about, like I keep saying. If we're going to be more educated consumers, I think understanding a little more of the reality around alcohol is really important. So we're talking about facts today. And I believe that we can become really convoluted in this topic by opinions and preferences. And you know what? Let's just go for it. Let's just go for it.
I'm excited.
Right off the bat. So the first sentence on the World Health Organization's health topic page on alcohol says, alcohol is a toxic and psychoactive substance with dependence-producing properties.
And really
okay,
fun.
Tell me,
yeah, come on, World Health.
Tell me how you really feel. Again, alcohol is a toxic and psychoactive substance with dependence-producing properties. All right. So when alcohol was discovered as something that can be consumed, I don't believe this was the intention. And it's believed that the initial discovery of alcohol was very much accidental, right? Because alcohol comes through fermentation, and it was most likely accidental fermentation of fruits or grains. And it's thought that was as far back as 10,000 years BCE, which is just like, my brain doesn't even compute. If we fast forward a few thousand years, beer and wine drinking became more prevalent because it was safe and it was healthy. Monasteries brewed beer, and we're kind of talking like medieval times, and that beer was probably about 1-2% alcohol content. So really, really weak. And kids and teens and adults are all drinking this because it was safer. It was disinfected. It was more easily preserved. So it was very much about what made sense for keeping the population healthy. And, you know, because this isn't a history episode, we're going to speed this up. But long story short, drinks got stronger. Spirits came about, initially used medicinally, but then like kind of, you know, shots changed. And then it all became mass produced and commercialized. And that's where we're at now.
I like it.
It's a little history lesson for you.
No. I like it. I'm a little sad not delving into the history, but it's fine. This is not a history podcast, Kate, so we shall soldier on.
We'll move forward. It's in the resources. Yeah. You can find it in awesome. My references. So you know me, always doing a little too much with how long my scripts are. It's hard for me not to go down this whole rabbit hole of like all these social aspects of alcohol consumption, like classism and cultural differences.
Honestly,
and like,
it's so funny. Like for anyone who doesn't kind of keep an eye on Kate's stories on Instagram, please do. But yes, last night you posted up kind of another essay that you'd written in research for this episode. And this is a common theme now. I think you do a hell of a lot of research for these episodes, which is awesome. It makes them great. But I also do fear for you a little bit, Kate. Like you spend a lot of time on them.
It's so bad and unnecessary, like how much time I spend. But no. Then I like, it's also personal. I'm like, I am having a lot of fun learning about this too.
It's great. So I just think, how do you get anything else done? Because you spend a lot of time on it.
Well, if you saw my stories last night, this was done in the late hours of 11 of midnight, times when I should be sleeping. Yeah. So with, you know, my gazillion pages of notes and stuff, Michael, your job is to keep me on track, because we're just going to acknowledge that all those things exist, like generational impacts and religion and all this stuff. And we're going to talk about alcohol and our health, because that's like actually my wheelhouse here. So let's talk about macronutrients. Macronutrients, the building blocks of our foods that we eat, drinks that we drink, protein, fats, and carbs. There's actually a fourth macronutrient, and it's alcohol. It just kind of is different than these other guys because it's non-essential. So like, we don't need alcohol to function. Our body doesn't need it to complete all these other processes that are really important that protein, fats, and carbs help us complete. So they each of these macronutrients have a caloric value, and they make up the foods we eat. And alcohol's kind of has some similarities, kind of has some differences, but alcohol does provide energy. Ethanol, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about alcohol, right? It does contain calories. So alcohol contains 7 calories per gram. And that is actually pretty calorically dense, given that protein and carbs contain 4 calories per gram. Though it's a little less than fat, which contains 9 calories per gram. So it kind of like sits in the middle. But while it does have caloric value, there are minimal to no nutrients in alcohol. So we're talking vitamins, minerals, fiber here. This leaves the caloric value of alcohol disproportionately high for the minimal nutrients provided. So we're saying we're consuming a lot of calories when we're drinking alcohol, but we're not getting a lot of like beneficial calories as far as micronutrients. So something I talk about so often with my clients is awareness, right? The way that our bodies process alcohol is also a little bit different when comparing it to other macronutrients. And this is very dependent on our consumption level. And this is very dependent on our consumption level, which I think is really important to point out here. Everything we talk about is dependent on consumption, right? So there's a dose response toxicity that alcohol exhibits. In smaller amounts, alcohol can behave a little more like a food than a toxin, and there aren't as many observable harmful effects. But if we increase our intake, alcohol behaves more like the neurotoxin that it is. It damages tissues and suppresses physiological processes and inhibits the central nervous system. So it just depends on how much you drink. It's about moderation and amounts consumed. And this is true for everything, but I would say it's way more important when it comes to drinking patterns. So when alcohol is present, it receives metabolic priority, meaning the body metabolizes it first. It's a neurotoxin. Need it to get out of there, right? And on the way through our digestive system, some alcohol is absorbed through by the tongue and the mouth, and then it's absorbed directly into the bloodstream through the tissue lining once it makes it to the stomach. And this is why it matters if we have food in our stomach when we drink, right? Empty stomach, and you feel it a lot sooner because the food isn't, there's no food to like absorb that alcohol as well. And we don't need to go into all of this alcohol metabolism, but know that it's handled in the liver. So all of that alcohol in our bloodstream comes out via sweat, urine, or our breath, and it can only do that so quickly. So there's nothing that can speed up this process. Water, cold shower, coffee, it doesn't speed up reducing our blood alcohol level. That's just time. It can just make us feel different. Now, here's where, to me, this is very interesting because it's more like the line in which I work as far as nutrition and nutrition education goes, but alcohol doesn't trigger hormones like leptin. So leptin is a hormone that says, hey, I'm full, stop eating. It doesn't send that signal like food does. So this means it doesn't create feelings of fullness or satiety. And I found this really interesting study, and it was a little outdated. I want to say it was from 2010 in the journal Physiology and Behavior, but it shows that alcohol actually makes us feel hungrier. And then once we start eating, even hungrier. So basically, we have this calorically dense substance that when consumed doesn't trigger satiety. We're drinking calories, but we're not feeling full. And instead of feeling full, we're actually feeling hungry. And then when we start to eat, we feel even hungrier. And when we pair this with impaired decision-making and lower inhibitions, which is just like byproduct of alcohol, we see a really big tendency towards overconsumption.
That's really cool and quite scary at the same time. We're going to get like a cultural chat now between the US and the UK. Is there like a big culture in the US of going out to certain places to eat after you've been out drinking? That might be a silly question. Yeah. Is it like kebab houses? Is that what you guys have over there that people go to or not?
I know all of my kebab is like in New York City. That is the thing. I feel like in California or more West Coast, where I'm only speaking from my experience, it's like these late night Mexican spots or Taco Bell or, you know, like it's like sloppy fast food, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like basically the grossest thing you can put in between like a bit of bread, sold. Like that's what people want to eat over here.
Like the places that are open when you're really drunk at 2 a.m.
Exactly. Like the kind of place, like there's usually like a couple of fights, like people that like, yeah, it's that kind of place. I haven't been to one in a long time. We'll get onto this. I don't really drink too much anymore. But yeah, it was a fun part of the night going out and finding the worst place selling food that you could consume something from. Yeah.
Right. In my experience, that was like one of the best parts too, because it was like, oh, I wouldn't normally eat this, so, but like, you know, at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Go time. So, you know, and this is just one aspect of our nutrition. I'm not going to pretend that excess calories are like the end of the world because they're not. But I bring this up because it's a pattern that I think gets overlooked really often. Like we just said, like there's permission that like, oh, when you have the drunchies, you go out and eat whatever and it doesn't count. Right. And
I've never heard that term before. The drunchies. What's going on? I've never heard that word.
I like the drunk munchies.
Never heard that term before. I'm using it.
I don't know where I got that. I don't know where I got that, but it's the drunk munchies. So it's been found as well in several cohort studies that most individuals like really wildly underestimate their alcohol consumption. So I found several studies across the board, but, and you know, the amount underestimated varied quite a bit, but it looked like around 33 to 60% of their intake was underestimated. Mm-hmm. That's like pretty significant. So you mix that with the drunchies and we're talking about some really significant overconsumption. And like I said, this is not the end of the world, but I think there's this huge difference between kind of what we talk about, Michael, with our clients of like giving ourselves permission to eat foods we may have feared before and, you know, like not label foods good and bad. And you know, in the daytime when we're all in our right mind versus this like extreme overconsumption that happens at times when we don't even have a recollection of it sometimes. And we're also underestimating the impact it's making on our overall intake.
Yeah.
So While we're potentially eating Beto's at 2 a.m., that was my college go-to 24-hour Mexican spot. There's a lot of other.
We had. I feel like I need to do a shout out to. So the place we used to go. So I studied in Oxford, and I lived there for 3 years. And we used to go to a place called the Kebab Kid. They had like three of them around the city. Brilliant food. They're cheesy chips. Still, like one of the greatest things.
Yeah, okay, that sounds fantastic. Hats off to these places because they have to deal with the most intolerable people.
Yeah, it must be brutal working in them, but I appreciate them for being there. Thank you, Kebab Kid.
Maybe they get tipped really well on acting at times. So while this is happening, there's other physiological changes going on. Our bodies are releasing stress hormones. Our immune system is compromised. We see some disrupted testosterone and sex drive. Kind of depends on the person and age. But we're going to have an inflammatory response to alcohol that we may feel in puffiness or heaviness the next day, or hangover symptoms like headache and nausea. Long-term, that chronic inflammation is a catalyst for increased risk of various health conditions, but short-term, we feel it as well. And our sleep is really impaired. So after drinking, we're not going to get good REM sleep, which is that deep restorative sleep we need for recovery. You know, you're drowsy, but sleep is light and disturbed. And this is not an extensive list by any means, because we could just like spend a lot of time going through some of these health risks or the negative impact on our health from drinking. And we're not even like in this short list talking long-term implications as much. There is a lot of long-term impact on health and disease risk. These are more short-term impacts. And I want to make it really clear that, again, the dose makes the poison, right? So we're not some of these things you're going to experience with even moderate drinking, like how it impacts our REM sleep. But this is more true with effects like lowered inhibitions and altered behavior short-term. We're going to see to some extent all of this happening regardless of the amount we drink, but it definitely depends on amount.
And also, I guess, individual response to that too. Like, you know, when we had Dr. Giles here on, he was talking about how he can't really touch alcohol. It just doesn't sit well with him, right? So some people may have a really high tolerance of consumption, whereas others get impacted very quickly in comparison to that. So I'm assuming that's true. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's both genetic and like tolerance based. Mm-hmm. So there's just, that's why I said it's like so hard. There's so many moving parts here. And again, this list of how it impacts us, this is fact. These are facts. Not opinions. So like, this is just what happens. And I say that because most of these facts are negative. So I know that it can seem like an attack, and I double pinky promise that it's not, but let's talk about benefits because, you know, there's a lot of purported benefits. Michael, what do you know? What benefits of alcohol do you know?
You look really cool. You become a really good dancer. You become more confident in the way that you speak. Well, at least you think that you're speaking better when you're drinking alcohol. Yeah.
There you go.
I feel a bit weird listing all the benefits of drinking alcohol, but here we are.
No, that's great. I'm going to add to that, but actually I like that you said that because I didn't get to all of those. Numerous studies show that moderate alcohol consumption, which is about one drink per day for women and two for men, is associated with lower risk of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes compared to alcohol abstinence.
I love that you were thinking like scientific benefits and I went straight to, I become really good at dancing.
I'm going to get to that part too, though. We're going to go to all of it. So
I really hope wrong. That everyone listening went straight to the same points, not the scientific benefits, because now I'm going to feel like an idiot.
I'm really glad I asked that question. So these health benefits appear to be due to alcohol's ability to raise HDL, which is our good cholesterol. I think I always think of it like H, healthy cholesterol versus L, lousy. I don't know. That's how I learned it in like college biology. And higher HDL levels are associated with greater protection against heart disease. However, dose makes the poison. Increasing alcohol intake more than this moderate intake can increase risk of hypertension, abnormal heart rhythm, stroke, heart attack, and death. So it's like a real small bell curve we're dealing with here. There's this small, moderate amount of intake that has shown health to provide health benefits. But then if you go above that moderate intake, you're crossing over into health risks. And what's tough here is that we're humans and moderation is not our strong suit. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be majority of the time, but then there's those times where it's not. So another thing, regular moderate drinkers are less likely to get kidney stones. 41% less likely, to be clear, for those who drink beer, sorry. And then 33% for wine drinkers, which is still pretty significant. And part of the reason may be that alcohol, like caffeine, you know, is a diuretic. So it makes you pee more often. And that helps clear out the tiny crystals that form stones. But then if you drink too much, you can get dehydrated and that can increase your risk of kidney stones. So again, careful. It's all about the moderate intake here. There's a large section of literature that shows positive benefits in decreasing cardiovascular disease and hypertension and even Alzheimer's with moderate intake, with when specifically looking at the polyphenol content of red wine. So when you look at like health benefits in alcohol, a lot of it is focused on red wine because it does have these, you know, polyphenol antioxidant properties and is like, no one's looking at tequila. No one's like, what are the health benefits of vodka, right? A lot of this comes down to red wine. And to your point, Michael, drinking is a very social activity. And we know that being social is good and having community is really important to our health. Like the things you're saying are very real.
I thank you for coming around to the most important points here, Kate. I appreciate that. It's one of those as well as you probably might go onto this, and I'm sorry if I'm jumping the gun slightly. So we speak about most of the benefits come from things like drinking red wine because the polyphenols, we can get those elsewhere, right? Like we don't have to drink wine to consume polyphenols. Correct. Yeah, okay.
Correct. So let's move on to that because, like I said, we're talking about these benefits from moderate intake, which is about one drink per day. Seven drinks on Saturday doesn't equal moderate intake of one drink per day. Like the math doesn't math that way. And because that's a really different burden on our body. So also these benefits shift over time. In general, risks exceed benefits until about middle age. And then at middle age, when cardiovascular disease begins to account for like a lot more of the burden of disease and death, these benefits may actually play a role. Mm-hmm. But it's not, I don't know, if you're physically fit and active and don't smoke and eat a healthy diet and have no family history of heart disease, drinking alcohol like isn't going to do much to decrease your risk of CVD. Mm-hmm. And if you have a family history of alcoholism, like, okay, these benefits are just not, they pale in comparison mm-hmm. to risks. So to use this argument to say like, yeah, start drinking for your health. Like that ain't it. Like that's not going to happen. And I think this is where we take this risk assessment approach and say like, okay, there's a lot of nuance in this topic. We have these health benefits of lower risk of heart disease, et cetera, et cetera. And even little things like the red wine with the polyphenols. But we also know that these health benefits are not unique to alcohol, right? Like exercise, movement, healthful diet, eating vegetables, the same polyphenols that you find in the grape skin when you just eat the grape, like those exist outside of alcohol. And I personally think that like taking this risk assessment approach comes down to the social aspect and the enjoyment. And that's why I'm saying, no, you've hit it right on the head. Like, can we just kind of get rid of the idea that there's health benefits here? Because they aren't that beneficial in the long run compared to the risks. So let's accept that the benefits are enjoyment and celebration and social time and community and these things that like actually more likely drive our consumption.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It's how the Mediterranean diet gets branded as the most healthy diet and then people try and eat a specific way, but it's not. It's kind of the community aspect and all the other added benefits there. And it's funny, it's usually, we've all seen the news, right? When a random, very obscure study comes out showing that a glass of wine every 2 days is showing health benefits, and it just gets blown massively out of proportion without looking at the bigger picture. And it's just, yeah, incredibly unhelpful. I think is the way you put it is pretty accurate there. It's looking at the wider picture of alcohol intake. Is it showing much benefit? Probably not.
Right. And so, because I really wanted to approach this in like a really unbiased way or as unbiased as possible, I did listen to this whole podcast episode on the benefits of alcohol. And it was by Tim Spector. So there's that. Okay. But I tried. I wanted to see the reasoning, you know. Long story short, nonsense. But, you know, I wanted to get that side as well. But I think this idea of risk assessment is more about enjoying the benefits and enjoying an event or a dinner or time with friends versus the impact of how that's going to affect our sleep and our stress and our performance, right? Let's just like pretend that these... that like strip away this idea of the health benefits and risk. And it's like, how are we going to feel versus what we're going to enjoy? And this approach seems to me far more realistic.
Yeah.
So I was talking to a friend, like when I like to do these episodes, I just like chat with people around me like, hey, I'm going to do this. Like what this topic, what do you want to know about it? You know, cause it gives some good insight.
I hope you did it scientifically, Kate. Like you chose a friend that likes to get on it every weekend. Then you chose like a teetotal friend, right?
Totally did it that way. But this friend, my friend Angie, she just completed precision nutrition, the level one cert. And so she said that I said like, hey, what did that say about alcohol? You know, I read PN articles, but I couldn't tell you what their philosophy is. And she said like, reading between the lines, it kind of felt like they said, this is highly personal, don't touch on it, you know, like until you have like a really established relationship with your client. And I really agree with that. I think it takes time to build that relationship in like a coach-client relationship where these conversations can happen. There has to be like this trust and respect and kind of a safe space to share because it is really personal. But I do often share earlier in a relationship with a new client, like, hey, this is how alcohol is relevant to our intake. That's a fact. Like, I mean, not like in a snarky way, but like, that's just, it's just what it is, right? Like, let's take that into account. Mm-hmm. And then down the line, we can talk about like, hey, what is like the benefit here? Like what, you know, how is this aiding you or taking a little farther from the goals we're working on? And,
I do exactly the same thing as well. It's like in the very bottom of my nutrition plans, I always have like a little point on alcohol of, I'll never tell anyone not to drink, but this is kind of what happens when we do. And then hopefully it opens up the discussion if someone feels comfortable too.
Exactly. Because I think that's what's important, being able to open up those doors to talk about it and like decide, is this something we want to address or not? Because maybe the answer is no, and that's fine. And I think of this client, I absolutely love her. I think we've been together just about a year now. And she, where she lives in the United States, very heavy drinking culture. It's like very much craft brewery on the weekends, like go on a hike and then go to the brewery type of vibe. And
everyone in the joint has a dodgy mustache or a big beard, right? That kind of place.
And flannel, probably. Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, for... let's say 10 months of our 12 months, it's been like, this is what I do on the weekend, period. And our approach has been, okay, let's just make sure we take into account how that impacts overall intake, how you feel, et cetera. And it's very recently that we've opened the conversation of like, I feel really pressured into this. Like I actually, I feel a little more tired. My workouts don't feel good. And she has performance related goals. You know, I feel like kind of puffy, icky. The next day is just like the first half of the day is a little lost to me. All of these different things of like, this is how it impacts me, but the pressure is like really strong. And I'm, you know, this is N equals one. Our approach has been like, can we just decide when it's worth it? You know, cause maybe sometimes it doesn't feel worth it. And can you have a plan B, an option of like, this is what I'm going to get to drink, or I'm going to have a glass of water between every drink, or I'm going to limit myself to one drink on the weeknights, you know? And it's really taking an individualized approach as always, but I think that trust and conversation have to be there first because no one, you know, it doesn't work to tell people what to do, nor is my goal ever to tell people what to do. Same as you, right? Like you're never going to tell someone to not drink because that's not a solution, especially when it's important to them.
Yeah. And also with just how personal it can be, because you never know someone's true background, right? Unfortunately, alcohol comes with a myriad of different potential issues. So it's it's a very delicate topic, right, as a coach to navigate. But yeah, I feel like just opening the door up initially to allow them to step into it if they want is usually the best approach.
I agree. So in this context of like, let's kind of strip away the idea that anyone's drinking for health benefits, I think the conversation shifts a bit more to drinking culture. And now I'm living in Mexico, you're in the UK, my knowledge kind of lies in the US, where I've lived up until the last 3 years. But I can tell you that in my opinion, now we're in the opinion part, right? In my opinion, the drinking culture in the US is absolutely wild, because drinking is very socially acceptable. It's commonplace. It's what you do at dinners and parties and sporting events and almost any holiday. And at the same time, we have this age limit of 21 years old and some of the highest rates of binge drinking in the world. And I, like, again, this is my experience, that exposure to alcohol and talk about alcohol is very abstinence based. It's like, you know, just don't. And then you enter college and you're 18 and you're not even legally able to drink, and you have minimal exposure to alcohol for some, and you just like go in, fingers crossed that it's not a total train wreck. And then somewhere in between like college and post-college, you're supposed to like learn how to have this moderate social relationship with alcohol, when that's never really been taught. It's just been this absence-based approach, and then like you're let loose. And it's, in my opinion, it's a really big ask. And I know that a lot of this reflects on my personal experience, and it's not the norm for everyone, because some people have their families exposing them earlier, or, you know, whatever that may look like. But I just know that there's this like really significant college binge drinking culture, and an abstinence-only approach is partially responsible for it, because almost all research points to abstinence approach in any topic being harmful and ineffective. And so when we look at statistics around drinking, rates of binge drinking are steadily increasing. And where we see that increase the most is for women and older Americans. So that's like 50 and up, which was really interesting to me. It's been noted over the past few decades that the way we drink has gotten more intense. So not just amount, but like the intensity or the binge drinking. In the show notes, I'm going to link to this New York Times op-ed. And yes, it's an opinion piece, but you know, it brings up some really interesting points and interviews with a few clinical psychologists working in the space. And I think it, because we don't have time to talk about everything here, it hashes out a lot of the nuance around mental health and reasons for drinking and how drinking habits are evolving, because there's so much to talk about here. But in one part of the article says that epidemiologists report that excessive and binge drinking begins in college, and that for many, because we don't have this you know, moderation in place, it continues through early adulthood into like after work happy hours. And so the US definitely has its own problems. I'm really curious about the UK with a different drinking age limit. Do you see a potentially different approach, or does that feel pretty spot on still?
Unfortunately, it feels pretty spot on still. It's, yeah, so our drinking age is 18. And yeah, I think it's similar, isn't it? The whole you shouldn't drink alcohol until you're 18, it does create this almost like, oh, what's that like before you get to the age of 18? So people are really keen. And it's just binge drinking culture here is huge. I think back to when I was at school, much younger than 18, and we'd meet up with friends in parks and drink alcohol quite regularly, because it's just kind of what people did. Like, that's the culture over here. And then you kind of hit university age. I think we went out every night for the first 3 weeks, apart from one night, because we all had some weird sickness bug, obviously, because we've been out drinking for many nights. And it's just, yeah, that is the culture. You go out and get absolutely hammered. You drink as much as you can in a very short space of time, and it's kind of celebrated. And if you're not wanting to be part of that, you're the weird one. Looking back on it now, it's very bizarre. But that still, unfortunately, I think is the culture around, especially university age, people of going out and just getting absolutely plastered. But yeah, I do.
It's like this whole system is set up for that, right? Like you're saying, no, don't touch it. It's bad. Until, okay, check, you're legal. Like, go for it. It's not bad anymore. And you're like, whoa, I feel like we're missing some really important education here. You know,
yeah,
and,
it's so
and
true.
The education is like in middle school when they're like, alcohol kills your brain cells. That's not even true. It doesn't kill your brain cells. But it does a lot of other things, but kill your brain cells isn't one of them. And so you just like grow up kind of scared until it's like, unleash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm half Spanish. My dad's from Spain, and the culture over there is just completely different. Like when you're a lot younger, you'll maybe get a little bit of red wine with your meal because the adults are sitting around the table and enjoying a glass of red wine. Like the approach to alcohol is completely different, and you don't, I'm sure you still do to some extent, but you don't see the kind of like huge binge drinking culture over there like you do over here. Same goes for kind of like France and Germany too. I just feel like the UK and the US do feel a bit like outliers there slightly. And I wonder whether that is just more the community approach to alcohol rather than, I don't know what it is. This is just sure there's loads of factors. And then you start entering into political debates about how bad life is at the moment in terms of income and socioeconomic deprivation and stuff. Like, I think it all just goes hand in hand. But yeah, I it's pretty worrying. I'd like to think it's getting better. I think our generation, maybe slightly younger, there's a lot more people turning their back on alcohol. And I did see on the news a few days ago, actually, that a university was opening up a kind of alcohol-free club night thing for the first time, because there's a lot of students coming to university now that are not touching alcohol at all. So maybe it's slowly shifting.
Yeah.
That's probably like a very tiny proportion of the society, but it's a good sign, right?
Yeah, it starts somewhere, right? And we're not pushing this, you know, this message of don't drink. It's just like, be educated about it. And this mm-hmm. kind of, the structure we're talking about of like abstinence into like let loose lacks education entirely, you know, like that's one of the downfalls of this whole, pattern we see. And, you know, it's a really sensitive topic, and I want, it's hard to speak about alcohol and drinking in a way that takes into account all these complexities, like you said, like around drinking habits or relationship with alcohol. But I do know that those exist, and it's just hard to touch on them all. And it's a lot of it is that what we have to look at personally and delve into and assess for us, because, you know, like our history with alcohol and our relationship with it and experiences, it's all very personal. And, you know, so here's what I'm going to share. Kind of my experience, and I'm curious to hear yours, because I know you mentioned you don't drink as much anymore. So I grew up in a religion that has a very conservative approach, and I spent a lot of time growing up like connected to church activities. I don't think it was a bad thing. It was kind of how I grew up. And alcohol, from the way I was taught, was approached only within the context of morality. So it was like very much like drinking alcohol is bad. You're a bad person. Don't do it. You know, there's like abstinence only with this, like, let's also make you feel guilty about it approach. And I don't attribute that to my parents at all. Never, never, never. I don't think they ever made those claims, but it's very much the messaging we received in church, you know, and like church lessons and stuff through childhood and adolescence. So invariably, once I left the house and I went off to college and I was now surrounded by every single substance you can get your hands on, I went wild, as one does. And I had no concept of risks versus benefits, how to handle alcohol, the side effects, how it impacted me, none of it. Like none of it, other than like, now I'm a bad person, right? I can tell you, I'm so embarrassed to say this, but like, I just even remember, I've talked about this in other episodes, when I was 17, I started as a CrossFit coach. And so I coached CrossFit through college as well. And I can remember like showing up to my 8 a.m. Saturday classes, like still a bit tipsy and not knowing how to like handle that. And like, you know, feeling a lot of anxiety around it, but like being like, this is the norm. I guess I just have to kind of, you know, do it. And obviously there's a lot of issues there, and I'm sorry for everyone. If anyone's listening who's there, I'm so sorry. But anyway.
Don't apologize. This is going to be a therapy session for us both, Kate. Don't worry. Continue.
So I don't drink now. And that, you know, that made this episode hard to talk about because I'm not pushing my agenda. I have no problem with alcohol. I have no problem with those who drink. In fact, like we, especially here in Mexico, it's a very drinking heavy culture, and we still do all the things with friends and go out and whatever. And I have no problem being in an environment with alcohol, but while that early decision was like kind of forced on me through religion a little bit more, I can really now confidently say that like it's a decision for me. Do you know what I mean? Like from experiences I had during my time drinking, from kind of knowing how I want to feel and don't want to feel, and how much crap I need to get done every day and like really need to have my like head on clear for, like it's not worth it for me. So now it's what I wish it was a long time ago, like being a little more educated about what I want to feel, how I want to feel, and what makes sense or what's worth it for me. And like, that's the goal, not drinking, but being aware of the trade-offs and what's best for you and your goals and how you want to feel. And I think that's the big piece we're missing quite often.
I like that. It's thank you for sharing. I should probably say that first of all. I appreciate that. When I knew we were talking about this topic, I didn't know kind of how much depth to go into. Maybe I still have like a few hang-ups in terms of alcohol in relation to me growing up. I come from a family line of, on the kind of Spanish side, a lot of men in the family who had very bad relationship with alcohol and alcoholism. And that certainly skews my approach slightly from growing up within that. I don't know, even when I was a heavy drinker at university, like there was only that kind of like 2-3 year period where I would maybe consider myself a fairly regular heavy drinker. It never felt good for me. I don't know whether I was maybe just more open and honest about that and more in tune with how I feel just because of the work I was doing and whatever. But I always felt really bad on alcohol. Like my mental health was awful. My anxiety goes through the roof. I used to get hangovers that would last like 2-3 days, even though I wasn't drinking kind of maybe as much as some other people that I was living with were. So I think my independent tolerance to it is very low. And then also thinking about kind of family line of relationship with alcohol too, that was always at the back of my mind. So as when I finished university, I didn't drink that much anymore. And now I've slowly transitioned into a place where I just don't really want to drink alcohol at all. I'm not against it. I'm the same with you. Like a lot of my friends are quite big drinkers, drink regularly. I don't mind being around it. I've got no issue with that at all. But personally, it just makes me feel so bad, so awful that I'm better off without it. And I honestly couldn't even tell you the last time I had a drink. I've always said to myself, like, oh, if I'm at a wedding or a celebration, I'll have like a glass of wine or beer. But I can't even remember the last time that I did that because I feel so much better when I'm not. Which once again, kind of living in the UK, Scotland as well, big drinking culture. Like if you go out to celebrate something, you have a drink. If you're meeting with a friend, let's meet for a drink. It's just everything you seem to do, alcohol is at the centerpiece of it. So if you try and step away from that, you are viewed as a bit of a weirdo. I've definitely had friends who I used to meet up with regularly and would go for a pint that now I don't drink. I don't see them anymore. Probably weren't good friends anyway, if that's the result there. But I don't know, it's so difficult to make that decision. So I really appreciate why a lot of people struggle to step away from alcohol, because it does have such a big impact on the rest of their lives. Now the fact that I've stepped away from it, I feel so much better. My work is more efficient. I enjoy events more as well. I don't get a hangover for like 2-3 days afterwards. So that's just me. Like I really enjoy my training and feeling really good mentally. So I'm not going to say I'm never going to ever drink again, but it will maybe be like a beer every 6 months to a year, if that, and I'm happy. Also, alcohol-free drinks now are brilliant. I don't know if the alcohol-free drinks are as good in Mexico. Is there a big alcohol-free movement yet?
There's only like the Heineken, like the alcohol-free. And so here's another thing, and I know I'm very much in the minority. I hate the taste of alcohol. Like in these days of big drinking, I just had to get through it, you know? And we're not going to get into this, but some pretty terrible things happened to me in these drinking days. And so I think there's like a connection there with like the smell and taste and such, but also like beer to me is just disgusting. I don't know what pee tastes like, but it's like in my mind what pee tastes like. So like a non-alcoholic beer, I have some friends who are really into like being able to have that drink in their hand and like be social and have that like feel really comforting and stuff. So I'm all about it. But like for me, I just don't like it personally. But I don't see a lot of options here. And I will say, because I want to hear what you have access to, I will say, I can't speak to all of the culture in Mexico, but it's alcohol heavy. You know, there is an AA on every corner in the area in which I live. We are I'm in Oaxaca, in the land of mezcal, and you drink mezcal with about every meal. And I can tell you that when I became pregnant last year, I thought, oh my gosh, thank you. Like, for just a few months, no one's going to push alcohol on me so hard, because it becomes like a very, it's very cultural, but it's really respect as well. So it's like really hard to say no. And people are really, mm-hmm. really pushy about it. And especially like, but it's mezcal. Like this isn't alcohol, it's mezcal, you know? And instead my experience was, oh good, it's mm-hmm. good for the baby. Like, you know, here's your mezcal. Like the baby will be healthy because of it. And I was like, oh, okay. Not the experience I was expecting. I just thought I'd kind of get off scot-free for a few months, but that didn't happen. But anyway, so I haven't seen a wide array of non-alcoholic drinks, but I did see recently someone talk about like these THC-infused drinks that are kind of like coming in to mm-hmm. swoop out alcohol. I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting.
It's the same here. When I tell people I'm not drinking, it's like, well, why? You know, like, why are you not drinking? There must be something wrong with you. Yeah, there's so many here, alcohol-free drinks, and they are brilliant. It's weird when you drink an alcohol-free drink, which shows how much of it is psychological because it feels like you're drinking. And also, I like the taste of beer, a good beer. I do like the taste of. And so it's nice to be able to kind of join in that social experience together without having the alcohol aspect. But also it's a really good way of hiding that you're not drinking by having some sort of beer in your hand, because otherwise people do kind of say, oh, why are you not drinking? Go on, just have one drink, go on, it'll be fine. So it is quite a good way to mask it. It's sad that has to be a thing, but yeah, you get so many good craft beers that are alcohol free now. There we go, Kate. I'll have to come over to Scotland and I don't know if it's still open. It was pre-COVID. I've not been for a long time. There was like an alcohol-free bar. Like all it sold was alcohol-free drinks. That was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so that really helps us segue into this last thing I want to talk about. Have you heard the term sober curious?
No, I haven't.
Sober curious. It's this whole thing. It's this whole thing. And again, another one of my friends, it was one of my Kaylin coaches I was talking to about this topic. And she's like, oh yeah, I have several clients right now who are like entering this world of sober curious. And I was like, whoa, I actually haven't heard that term. Now this woman, Ruby Warrington, wrote a book called Sober Curious, The Blissful Sleep, Greater Focus, Limitless Presence, and Deep Connection awaiting us all on the other side of alcohol. I think that's kind of where that term came from. I'm not going to speak to this book. I don't know anything about it. I just believe that's where the term came from. And she said, being sober curious means literally to choose to question or get curious about every impulse, invitation, and expectation to drink versus mindlessly going along with the dominant drinking culture. And I found that pretty interesting, right? Because I kind of, again, opinion, think that's the approach we should take, just being like mindful rather than like mindlessly going along with it. So she said, sober curious is a term that means questioning your relationship with alcohol and thinking about trying sobriety, even if you're not ready to commit to it. So it's not about being sober. It's not about not drinking. It's about being mindful. And one of the goals of the movement is to push back on normalizing that heavy drinking has to be present in social situations and that those who don't drink are less social or less enjoyable. I thought that was really interesting because we seem to approach this topic as really black or white. Like you drink or you don't. If you do, you're fun. If not, like you're a total stick in the mud. And, or if not, like there has to be a really ominous reason why. And I kind of, you know, you alluded to that. Like it's hard to tell people, no, thank you. Well, why not? And sometimes I'll say, I don't want to.
It's like, well, you really don't want to know why. Like it will really ruin your evening.
Like, do you want? And for me, like, I think my answer is I don't want to. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all I got. Like, in the grand scheme of things, I think that's my answer, but it's mm-hmm. not, never seems good enough. So the first step of sober curiosity is paying attention to your alcohol consumption. And I'm not, this is not me saying like, we should all go sober curious, like not at all. But I think that step of paying attention to your alcohol consumption, I think that's a good place to be. Mm-hmm. I think if you're anywhere in the realm of drinking, whatever that looks like for you, paying attention to consumption is a good place to be. So when we're talking about this risk analysis of benefits and negatives and all that, I think there's space for the answer to be, yeah, have a drink. You know, it's enjoyment and celebration and it's socializing. And maybe that's the move. Having a drink is the move, or having a few drinks. But maybe that first assessment can also get us realizing, like, am I drinking to cope with stress? Am I drinking to fit in? you know, and just have a little more awareness so we can weigh those positives and negatives in that context. And, you know, there's so much to be said here, but
it's like intuitive drinking. That's kind of what it sounds like, right? Yeah. It's kind of like the intuitive eating version of alcohol. I like that.
Right. And I don't know. I love what you just said, because intuitive eating doesn't put anything off limits or on, like, you know, it doesn't say do this or do that. It's just like, hey, be in tune with what you're doing. I mean, that's a really simplified way to explain it. But so back to the subjective information, I want to kind of start to wrap it up. Consumption of alcohol does have some really tough impacts on our health, period. I don't even think we went into a lot of them. It's all about dose response toxicity. So intake of this toxin in large amounts, like with any, you know, long-term heavy drinking, has negative impacts on our liver, heart, pancreas, brain, etc. It increases the risk of cirrhosis and neurological damage, and impairs our immune system, and it disrupts our sleep cycles. Like, all of that is true. It's a fact. And as far as our nutrition and fitness goes, drinking really can impact our caloric consumption, and alcohol impedes our ability to perform and recover. I think what's very interesting in this very convoluted world of online information, there's a lot of talk about detoxing, right? Like with a tea or an oil or whatever, or like the toxins in the grocery store, like in the cereal or the candy. And there's so much that can be said about all that. Like we could do a whole episode on that, right? But we do know that alcohol is a toxin, and it somehow, like, we oftentimes skip over that one, you know, and we talk about the cereal or whatever. But alcohol is a group one carcinogen, which is the group one is labeled carcinogenic to humans. For reference, the recent hubbub about aspartame as a carcinogen has aspartame as a group 2B carcinogen. So there's group one, then 2A, then 2B. So it's like the third one down, which is classified as possibly carcinogenic to humans. So I just like want to leave that there, because, you know, there's a lot of like, lot of talk there. I think that may be a whole other topic, more on misinformation, like misleading media, to be honest. But hopefully we've shared these facts with like, with the intention that we can be educated and intentional about what we consume, and just maybe take a look at our drinking patterns, because I think there's a lot of value in there, whether that means changing anything or not, because it might mean not changing anything, and that's fine too. This episode does not come with a recommendation beyond, hey, let's bring a little awareness to what you're doing and what your relationship with alcohol looks like.
I think you delivered that in a very balanced way, Kate. Good work.
Thank you. And you kept me on you kept me on track, so thank you for that.
That's okay. And I don't know, all I will say is, since I stopped drinking, it feels weird saying that, because I'm not saying I'm never drinking again, but since I stopped kind of regularly drinking, like, my food choices are better, my sleep is better, my motivation's better, like everything else just tended to fall into place. So if anyone listening to this is sober curious, I recommend it, because I feel so much better. But we should probably as well, in the show notes, we'll list like a few alcohol resources as well, if anyone listening to this feels like they need any extra support too. And please reach out to either of us if you have any further questions, because Kate did an essay on this, so she is very well informed and can help you out.
Well, I would love to generate some discussion, because I think this is something that, like our, talking about our relationship with alcohol kind of stays personal and hush hush, but I think a lot of people are on the same wavelength in a way, not our wavelength necessarily, but in a different way. And there's a lot of, we talk about, you know, drinking being community. There's a lot of community in finding people with similar behaviors and kind of patterns and desires as well. And like, to be honest, I know you and I have talked like very, very minimally about this, but like, we're kind of on the same wavelength, it sounds like, in terms of our choices around alcohol and such. So I think there's a lot of talk to be had.
There is. Thank you so much, Kate. Absolutely nailed it. Cool. Thank you so much for listening, guys. And we'll see you all again next week.